Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, and happy Monday, everyone. Well, it's officially the law in our state. Governor Rick Snyder signed the Medicaid expansion into law today. It would provide Medicaid services to hundreds of thousands of working poor in Michigan through the Federal Affordable Care Act. On today's program, what the expansion means for Michigan and what's next for the governor and on the legislature's agenda. But first, in Michigan, by state law, the day after Labor Day is back to school day. But in some 30 districts and charter schools around the state, kids have already been going to school because these districts and schools are experimenting with a year-round schedule. It's a concept getting a lot of attention with the realization that our traditional school schedule causes most kids to forget some of the reading and math skills over that long summer break. And that forces teachers to spend the first month or even more reteaching the previous year's material. Just last week, State Representative Andy Shore introduced House Bill 4982. It would set aside $10 million to help schools transition into a year-round calendar. But just how does a year-round school work, and is there really a demand for it? For some answers, we turn to the Croswell Lexington Community Schools in rural Sanilac County, which is now offering the option of a year-round schedule. Superintendent Kevin Miller joins the program now. Welcome, Kevin.
Well, thank you, Cynthia. It's good to be here.
Why did you believe, Kevin, that it was worth a shot to offer a year-round schedule to your students?
We just know, Cynthia, how much time we spend remediating or coming back in the fall and doing reteaching of concepts that were learned the previous year. And then when you back that up with data that we've been seeing throughout the years, it's really been on my mind for years and years. And so this past winter, we just made a decision that we were going to offer it up on a voluntary basis to both staff and students and see if there was interest in our community. I know some districts have tried to basically turn one of their entire buildings into a year-round. We said that we're not going to do that because we have two communities and then surrounding townships. We didn't want to say that our elementary school in Lexington was going to be a year-round school. And by the way, if you don't like that, you have to go over to Croswell School because that's our neighborhood school. So we opened up classrooms in each building to be able to do this. But let me give you a little bit of data that basically hit me over the head this past winter. A survey, and I don't have it in front of me, the organization that did it, but the survey was done with 5,000 teachers. Of those 5,000 teachers, 80% of them said, I spend 3 to 4 weeks in the fall reteaching what was lost over the summer from the previous year. That's fine. I get that. Mm-hmm. What was scarier to me was 50% of those 5,000 teachers said that they spend 7 to 8 weeks in the fall. And that, to me, is criminal, that if we're going to spend 40 to 45 days in the new school year reteaching the previous school year, then we've lost, you know, 100 of our 180 school days, we've lost 40 of those to reteaching.
And when you think of the cost and the resources of having those schools open, you're basically paying for the same information twice.
Exactly. So we said, you know, the concept, we modified what a traditional 45-15 or 9 weeks on, 3 weeks off concept. We modified it a little bit. We brought parents in. We had several open meetings in our high school cafeteria for the community to ask questions. The very first meeting, we got overwhelmed. We were taking bets on how many, you know, kids and parents we'd have there, and we were overwhelmed. We had over 150 parents show up at our very first meeting. Overwhelmingly supportive in the concept, understood it, why. And so we ended up with, you know, 262 kids in our first year. That's about 30% of our entire K-5 population.
And you were hoping for, what would you have thought would have been a good response?
Well, I was telling Julie Western, our director of curriculum instruction, I said, gosh, I'd be thrilled with 130 or 140. So we almost doubled that.
Wow, basically. 262.
Yes.
And from what grade span again?
We were started out K-4, but the parents that came to the meetings told us, you know, I've got a fifth or a sixth grader and a third grader. We'd sure love to see you look at this for the middle school or at least grades 5 and 6 to start. So we listened to our public, And we ended up doing a self-contained fifth grade and a self-contained sixth grade classroom that looks somewhat like an elementary school. I mean, they still change classes a little bit during the day, but mm-hmm. we built a fifth and sixth grade classroom as well for year-round. So we're K-6.
That's Superintendent Kevin Miller of the Croswell Lexington Community Schools in Sanilac County. They're offering the option of a year-round schedule and had 262 students sign up to be part of that. How did the teachers and staff at the Croswell Lexington Schools receive this idea?
It's funny, the very first time I brought the concept up, and we have what's called an Instructional Policies Council that consists of about 30 teachers and administrators. We meet several times a year, and I brought the concept. This is a group that I bounce things off of. So I went to them in January at a meeting, and I said, I've got several things that we're looking at. And we're known as a pretty innovative school district. We have an early college program. We have iPads for all 5th through 12th graders. I mean, we're very, very innovative and creative. Well, when I bring concepts to them, they usually just look at me and say, well, let's go, But I brought them the concept of year-round school, and when I got back to my desk after this meeting, spent a few minutes on the phone, I already had three or four emails from middle school staff saying, if you want to expand it to middle school, we're in.
Hmm.
And I had 9 or 10 elementary teachers already emailing and say, we're in. You want to go to this calendar? I would love to go to this calendar. I see the vision. I want to do it. So in all, we had about 20 teachers step forward and volunteer. We didn't use them all. We ended up having kind of a waiting list, the teachers that want to do it that we didn't use. But we ended up with two kindergartens, two first, two second, two thirds, two fourths, and a fifth and sixth grade section. So we ended up using about 15 teachers. We also have Title I support, special ed teacher that went to this calendar to service our special ed population. So in all, with aides and everybody, we have about 20, 21, 22 people working in this program.
And is it more expensive for you to be offering classes year-round?
Well, we had to add transportation for the kids in the summertime. So we normally, on a given day during the school year, would have 26 buses running. We have about 2,370 students. We ran 6 buses over the summer. And again, we listened to our public. They told us one of the only things that they said was, we get it. Is there any way that we could modify it a little bit so the kids could still have a little bit of summer? And so what we did is we modified that 9-week on, 3-week off a little bit, and we went to 4-day weeks in the summertime. So we went Monday through Thursday, and it was a huge hit with the public and a huge hit with our staff.
Now, how long, Kevin, do you think it'll be before you can make a determination as to whether these year-round classes are making an academic difference?
Well, let me just tell you about a conversation after the first 4 days of school. So we met with our year-round staff on Thursday afternoon of our first week. So all the kids took three weeks off, and they came back. July 8th was our first day of school for our year-round. So on July 11th, we met with staff after school, and even before our official meeting with year-round staff, and we had, 20 of them in the room, they were just kind of talking amongst themselves and saying, I think this might be my highest group I've ever had. And another teacher said, I think my group's really high too. Well, we're 70%+ free and reduced. We didn't stack the group with high kids. And in the contrary, we have a lot of our kids that really need to be, kind of our lowest learners that don't need 11 weeks off in these groups. Well, what we realized right off the bat, and they realized together, maybe it's not the highest group they've ever had. Maybe it's just because they didn't lose anything. And we didn't have to do any remediation or reteaching at all.
Do you expect test scores to really show something noticeable if we were talking a year from now?
Yes, I do. And I also expect, even in our first fall, we MEEP test in October. I would expect that those year-round kids, because they're already on they've been on the next year's calendar for some 55 days before we ever start MEEP testing. And if you're a firm believer, and I am, in spiral learning, in other words, you're constantly spiraling back learning from fourth grade in the first 40 days of fifth, if you understand what I'm
mm-hmm,
saying,
yeah.
Then you're constantly kind of cementing those things they learned in the previous grade while you're teaching new content. I would expect that we would see significant gains in those kids that have already been in school for 50, 55 days.
Any downside that you can see?
So what's the worst? This is what I told our staff and our parents. What's the worst that can happen? You're on a different 180-day calendar. I mean, that's the worst that can happen, right? Is you're on a different calendar. You're 9 weeks on, 3 weeks off. 9 weeks on, 3 weeks off. But what data has told us is that 3 weeks off versus 11 weeks off makes a huge difference, especially, in your introduction, I know you talked about math.
Mm-hmm.
Math we see, because that's such a linear. I'm not saying that as a pun. I mean, it's such a linear learning in math that we find that we have to go back and reteach the last kind of quarter of that year in the fall because of what they've forgotten when they come back. And we just saw that we didn't have to do that on July 8th. We just did not. They had not lost it.
Do you see this system easily working in other districts?
I think it depends on your community. We put it out there as just a topic of conversation, and we were overwhelmed by the response. I think each community needs to poll its residents. I think the way we did it, I would urge others to do it the way we did it, and not try to close a building down and make it a year-round school and force it down people's throats. I think the way we did it was it's a no-lose for our families. Our families will tell you, when we're a rural, you mentioned we're a rural community, a lot of farmland. We have had farm families speak to the local papers positively about this because they start their planting in mid-April, and they're busy through the summer. For the first time ever, they're going to be able to take a three-week vacation with their kids at Christmas and a three-week break in spring before they ever plant. It's been a huge hit for our agriculture families.
Do you envision a day, Kevin, when the traditional summer vacation will have gone the way of the one-room schoolhouse in Michigan or in America?
Maybe a generation from now. I think it's got to be a slow step. And the way we've done it, 262 kids this year, maybe it's 400 next year. Maybe we expand it to K-8. You know, you're talking to a guy that thinks way, I like to tell people I don't think outside the box. There is no box. So, you know, I've got some concept for high school that we could look at learning in high school, because we know that kids are losing information, especially in math and reading in the summertime. So I'd like to see us maybe down the road to go to a four quad system, kind of like what colleges do, that they have a summertime offering for kids that want to take summer classes. So I think eventually, yeah, I could see the day where some, most, or all kids are on a year-round format, or I can see that a day sooner that maybe it's half and half, that you're offering it for all, that some take advantage of it.
Kevin Miller, superintendent of the Croswell Lexington Community Schools in Sanilac County. Thanks, Kevin.
It's been a pleasure, Cynthia.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The news of Detroit's bankruptcy filing has been relentless. But that Chapter 9 filing does not seem to be stalling economic growth and development in and around downtown. Case in point, Rivertown, a $55 million proposed development along the East Riverfront that won approval from the Detroit Economic Development Corporation. Rivertown would have townhouses, apartments, and small-scale retail. Brian Holdwick is with the Detroit Economic Growth Corporation.
What makes it transformational is creating the start of the neighborhood, the East Riverfront neighborhood, which has been the vision since the city assembled the property back in the 90s and after the casinos relocated elsewhere throughout the city.
The five-block project is adjacent to the Milliken State Park just east of the Rensen. Holdwick expects construction to be underway by next spring and hopes to see everything complete by the end of 2016. McCormick Barron Salazar is the St. Louis-based developer who is not letting Detroit's bankruptcy derail its vision for the East Riverfront. Joining us now is the chairman and CEO, Richard Barron. Welcome to Stateside, sir.
Thank you.
Well, it seems real pivotal to understanding what is behind this proposed development to realize that you grew up in Detroit. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Livernois and Seven Mile in the city. And my family was in Detroit from the beginning of the 20th century. And my parents were both educated at Wayne State. And my maternal grandfather had a store in downtown Detroit for years, the Midwest Woolen Company. So my roots are very deep in Detroit.
And how long have you had your eye on doing something with the riverfront in Detroit?
Well, I've been trying to work in Detroit for a number of decades, very frankly. And it's not just the riverfront. We're also working in Midtown now on another project there. And I have always wanted to work in Detroit, and the situation has just never presented itself where it was possible for us to come in and do our kind of work.
Richard Barron, you head up a company that really specializes in reviving challenged and blighted urban neighborhoods. How did this become your focus?
Well, it really grew out of my work. I graduated from the University of Michigan Law School in 1968 and went to St. Louis, where I worked for many years on projects. I started McCormick Barron Salazar in 1973 and have been doing this kind of work ever since. We started in St. Louis and went to Kansas City and a number of other cities in the Midwest. And we work across the country now in a number of different cities. But I was always very interested in reclaiming these areas of cities that had fallen on hard times, that were blighted, knitting back community, dealing with schools and other kinds of programs to serve families and children, as well as try to integrate the arts in what we do. So it's been a very interesting career that we've had at McCormick Barron Salazar.
In fact, the company's website talks about making your developments holistic and sustainable. Can you tell us what would that look like in this Rivertown development?
Well, we will have a variety of different kinds of things that we'll integrate into the design, of course. We're very involved with all kinds of green design. But more importantly, we hope to restore a retail presence in the area. Many of the jazz clubs and other kind of nightlife venues were there at one time. And our hope is that it'll become a very, very popular place for families and children as well. We hope that with the parks and the Globe Building being restored, that it's going to become a very popular place for people to recreate as well as live.
There really has been a fair degree of attention recently paid to the ways Detroit has used or not used its riverfront. And I'm wondering, as someone who grew up here in the Detroit area, in the Southeast Michigan area, and with the perspective of someone who's been launching developments all around the country, what mistakes do you think were made in the past and what needs to be done to make this riverfront in Detroit something that really means something to the region?
Well, I think it started. I think the Conservancy project is extraordinary. I think there will be a wonderful renaissance at Belle Isle. And I think that there has always been some access to the water with boating and the like. And I think that Detroit actually has done a better job in some respects than the many other cities in the country that are on water. I can include in that list St. Louis, which cut itself off from the Mississippi decades ago by building the highways between downtown and the river. Fortunately, Detroit didn't do that, and so I think there's plenty of opportunity for that to occur. And hopefully our project and others like it will make the water even more accessible.
Certainly with the announcement of Rivertown and you coming to present this in Detroit about the time that the bankruptcy filing happened, I wanted to talk to you about that a little. And it's interesting, we had a conversation on the program with Bruce Katz of the Brookings Institution, who talked about the fact that there is a real difference between a city's fiscal troubles and its economic prospects. And it strikes me that your coming in with Rivertown underscores that.
That's very true. We really regard the bankruptcy as an opportunity for Detroit to kind of right itself in a positive way. Hopefully from those proceedings there will come a new fiscal management system of the city, and a lot of the poor decisions that were made over decades will finally be corrected in a way that will allow the city to function and deliver services. But in the meantime, we think that it's a extraordinary community, and it has awful lot of very good things happening. And we really regard it as a very good place to do business.
Richard Barron is the chairman and the CEO of McCormick Barron Salazar, and he spoke with us today telling us all about Rivertown, the new $55 million proposed development along five blocks of the East Riverfront in Detroit. Thanks for speaking with us today, sir.
My pleasure.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. They call themselves gifts or creatures.
Relics and ghosts, relics and ghosts. Relics and ghosts, relics and ghosts. Glory days of old.
That's Brandon and Bethany Foote with the song Relics and Ghosts off of their new album, Yesteryear Western Darkness. It's their second album out from Earthwork Music. The Lansing-based couple joins us now in the studio. Good to have you with us.
Great to be here. Yes.
Brandon, just so many of your songs explore the pre- and the post-industrial era here in the Rust Belt. So what kind of stories are you telling in Relics and Ghosts, the song we were listening to?
That story is looking at a lot of things. Our world's changing quickly. It's gotten very, very small in the past 100 years or so. And our album is exploring much of that. Relics and Ghosts is kind of a great pinpoint off of that. We're looking at climate change. We're looking at what we've done as a culture here in the West. I mean, what we continue to do as a culture here in the West, with the way that we've shaped America and the way that we're shaping the future for future generations and our children and grandchildren.
Bethany, what draws you both to these kinds of stories? This is heavy, heavy stuff.
Yeah. Well, you know, Brandon has a background in some environmental ed, and that's kind of what his undergrad degree was in. We're also a part of Earthwork Music, which does a lot of environmental education and awareness through music and the arts. And so I think that resonates with us. That's kind of an interest and a passion of ours personally. And then the stories kind of stem from a love for Michigan and a love for the Midwest and just seeing how those things overlap.
What's behind the title Yesteryear Western Darkness? It made me wonder, are we talking about the American West? Are we talking about Western civilization?
Western civilization mostly. We as a culture have had a huge impact on the rest of the planet. And the way that we work as a group of people here in the West, I question that. I question if it's for the better or for the worse. There's been some great inventions that have happened because of the technology and the advancement of Westernization. We explore Edison. We also explore Woody Guthrie. Great, you know, people that had many, you know, a few different elements of the kind of their focus of what it meant to be American. We also look at darker folks here in the West. We look at the Purple Gang from Detroit. Mm-hmm. We look at, going back to positive, we look at John Muir and his legacy that he left. John Muir was the founder of the Sierra Club.
I'm really struck with the gorgeousness of your sound and the gentleness of your voices together. But then you have lyrics like on Blind Pigs on High, who got up that nail show up photos. I'll beat you with my nightstick.
Beat you with my nightstick.
There's such a interesting dichotomy between your warm, gentle sound and then you're telling stories that are harsh stories, aren't they?
Yeah, there's an element of darkness in our music, and I think there's an element of darkness in the world. And I think it's our job to make sure people know about it, but also to bring an element of light to that darkness as we travel through this life.
Your voices are just perfect together. It's as if you were born singing together, but you didn't actually start making music together until after you were married. Is that true?
Yes, it is, actually. I grew up in a pretty musical family. I have two sisters and a brother, and my parents sang together. The three of us girls would sing together. So that was part of a normal life for me. Brandon kind of came into music a little bit later, kind of in his teen years, had played in quite a few configurations of bands. But yeah, after we got married.
And how long ago was that?
4 years ago.
All right.
Just in August. And we just kind of started exploring that idea of doing it together. I knew that part of him, and he knew that I could play piano and knew I could sing, but we hadn't done much together. So I think, you know, you throw two people into an apartment and we're starting a new life together, and it's like, okay, well, let's find something we can do together. And for us, it just came out very naturally in that way.
How exciting that must have been to discover that you gelled musically, because that doesn't always happen, does it?
No, not by any means. It definitely was a unique circumstance, and a really, really amazing kind of happening for our marriage and our life together. So.
Well, I just have to ask because, you know, when you just think of working long hours in the studio and rehearsing and touring and then being married, does there ever get a point of maybe a little too much togetherness, or are you all still early in that honeymoon phase?
Well, I think, you know, there's moments of stress that comes with that type of work, for sure. And we've had our moments. But I do think it also helps that we, you know, we balance that with other things in our lives. I'm an early childhood educator. Brandon works at a music store, actually. So we both have time away from each other. And I think that does help balance. I think it's important to have that kind of well-rounded approach to something that we can do together, and it's a pastime, and it's fun and enjoyable, but we also have some other things that we pursue separately, and it helps keep that balance, I think.
I'm speaking with Brandon and Bethany Foote. They are the group that calls themselves Gifts or Creatures, and their new sophomore album, Yesteryear Western Darkness, is out now from Earthwork Music. You tell Michigan stories in a lot of your tunes. This one, Telegraph Tramp, is about Thomas Edison.
Plank roads we foggy tenure, we'll put you on, I would climb up high. The birds of my youth sing no more. Come get your free press, Detroit's fine. Baggage car I present to you, a telegraph tramp, tramp telegraph.
What is the story, Brandon, that you're telling about Thomas Edison in this song?
Well, Edison was raised here as a young child in Michigan, and when he left his family, he went and rode the rails and actually worked on selling a newspaper out of the rail cars, and this tune's kind of about that journey that he had.
Out of Port Huron and off to the world?
Yeah, he left Port Huron and went and traveled all over the Midwest, and it was an interesting man. You know, he didn't sleep much, so he took power naps. I'm not an expert on any of these topics, but I love all of the stories, and I love hearing them and trying to put my own spin on them, so.
Now, you are part of the Earthwork Music Collective and other young musicians around the state. Tell us how the collective works.
Well, we're essentially a group of friends at the core of all of it, and that's really powerful and really amazing. Seth Bernard has helped us with both our records. He plays with Seth and May, for you folks that don't know him, an incredible Michigan folk duo. And he's kind of been the figurehead of the collective. His vision years ago was to start this group of people that would help support one another, play shows together, work on environmental advocacy, run a festival, both the family weekend, which we do in June, and then the Earthwork Harvest Gathering, which happens every September. And it's really just turned into a big family, and a lot of people ask if it's a label, and there's elements of it that work a little bit like a label, but mm-hmm. for the most part, this is all DIY. We're doing all of this ourselves. We're self-financing. You know, we do have a gentleman named Bill Chesney who does our website and does a lot of the kind of the behind-the-scenes work, but he's severely underpaid for what he does. So, you know, we're here in Michigan trying to make an impact on the culture and trying to lift each other up while we're doing this. And we've been saying lately, hey, let's be each other's hype men.
Talk it up. And do you think, Bethany, do you really kind of need that support from your fellow artists in order to survive in 2013 as a local artist?
Oh, I think so. Yeah. I mean, I know I have less experience than Brandon in that he's been playing in bands a lot longer than I have. But my experience with Earthwork has been so encouraging and so uplifting in the work that we're doing, but also just the camaraderie that we have. There's not that sense of competition other than positive competition, encouraging each other to do well, but there's more of a, you know, excitement about new records coming out or the work that we do and people playing on each other's albums and supporting each other when we can. And that camaraderie really has been an encouragement to us, I know, and opened a lot of doors that we certainly wouldn't have had without those connections and those friendships.
And with that in mind, now that you have put Yesteryear Western Darkness, put your baby out there to the world, are you planning to tour to support it?
We're playing throughout Michigan in the month ahead. Bethany and I both have other endeavors in life that we love, so we try to find that balance with our music. But we're going to be playing in Lansing and Grand Rapids and in Kalamazoo and in Ann Arbor and in Lake City and in Fentonville over the next month. So we're playing a bunch to kind of celebrate the release of this new album.
Gifts or Creatures, Brandon and Bethany Foote of Lansing, and the album is Yesteryear Western Darkness. And you can learn all about the tour dates and find out more about them and hear some clips from the album on their website, giftsorcreatures.com, giftsorcreatures.com. Thanks to both of you for coming in and talking with us today.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Ride the rails till I'm lonesome. Silver ships.
Still to come, after months of sometimes very contentious debate, Governor Snyder signed the Medicaid expansion into law today. With that complete, we turn to what's next for the fall agenda in Lansing. That conversation comes up next. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. Stateside, I'm Cynthia Canty. Well, after months and months of political wrangling and debate, Governor Snyder has signed the Medicaid expansion into law.
There we go. We're done.
The expansion provides Medicaid services to hundreds of thousands of working poor in Michigan through the Federal Affordable Care Act. Now, what's ahead? Joining us is Chris Gouts, Capital Correspondent for Crain's Detroit Business. Welcome back to the program, Chris.
Thank you.
And joined by Chad Livengood, the Lansing reporter for the Detroit News. Hello again, Chad.
Thanks for having me today.
So, gentlemen, after months and months, although to a lot of folks it seems a lot longer, Medicaid expansion has been signed into law. So what happens now with the expansion? Because of this whole procedural issue, it doesn't actually kick in until the spring, correct?
That's right. It won't become law or in effect until the 1st of April, roughly, roughly 90 days after the legislative session ends. This is presuming that the legislature works until the end of the year and then adjourns under their normal procedures. And this was a setback for the governor. I mean, the laws get immediate effect almost like clockwork these days in the legislature, and this one did not. It came up two votes short in the Senate, so that causes it to have a delay in when it actually goes into effect. And that means people won't start be able to sign up for Medicaid insurance until after the 1st of April.
But we're looking at a cost, aren't we, to the state. Isn't that true, Chris?
Yeah, that's one of the things that the opponents keep pointing out, that while this was a great victory, there's still a lot that needs to be done, and this is going to cost the state. You know, the Department of Community Health director puts this at about $7 million a day, but Republicans sort of take issue with that number, although Director Haveman said that is a good number, so you can extrapolate that out for, you know, 90 days to, you know, times seven. But there are some caveats with that. But it is going to cost the state, and it's going to look at, when you look at the projections that the governor was hoping for and taking a full year of revenue that was going to be gained by having the feds pick up some of the Medicaid costs. Now you have to deduct, you know, 90 days worth of that, presumably. And so that's less money that you have for other programs.
And Chad, isn't it possible that eligible recipients could actually wind up being fined? There could be federal penalties levied on them because of this?
It's possible, but the IRS hasn't been exactly firm yet on whether they're going to implement those fines if you don't have health insurance on January 1. If there's a delay like this, that might be a three-month delay. It hasn't. A lot of things with the Affordable Care Act, known as Obamacare, haven't exactly come through on all the deadlines, and so it's a little unclear that that's really going to end up being enforced. But what this means is that if you are an individual making up to roughly a little less than $15,000 a year, or $29,000 some change for a family of four, you'll be able to qualify for Medicaid. It's going to get a little more dicey with starting October 1st, when the healthcare exchanges go on board, and people will be able to log on and start buying insurance through these private insurance plans through these online exchanges. there will be an option for Medicaid, but people in Michigan won't be able to actually get it until the 1st of April or later. And so there's going to be there's a possibility that some people, low-income people between 100% to 133% of poverty level, actually could buy insurance on the exchange and then get Medicaid once it kicks in later next year. So there's going to be some hiccups because of this delay, that's for sure.
It's all kind of messy, especially over the summer, this whole Medicaid issue. How big a win was this for Rick Snyder?
I think it was a significant win. We'll see. You know, obviously he took heat from both sides on the right for even touching anything associated with Obamacare. He lost so many members that didn't want to see him do this. You know, you see it in the Tea Party anger over this and going after Lieutenant Governor Kelly over this issue and some other things. But then you had the left hitting him on the fact that he didn't push hard enough for immediate effect, as we've been talking about, that this delay that's going to happen. And one thing that was brought up and that it does seem kind of strange is that the governor made his point to delay his trip to China to make sure that Medicaid got done. But the only real issue that was hanging out there was whether or not lawmakers were going to give the bill immediate effect. But when I spoke with him, he told me that he didn't actually pick up the phone or talk to any senators from the time that the first immediate effect vote failed to when it was eventually just sent over to the House and approved without immediate effect. So we had the shower campaign and some others saying, what was the point of him sticking around if he wasn't going to try to wrangle two more votes?
Yeah.
It was kind of an odd thing.
This governor tends to get dinged on style. He we all know he's not a politician by trade, and he's a self-described nerd, and some other past governors might have picked up the phone after that vote, if anything, to just call and thank people for voting, or call and say, hey, I understand you're not for this, but look, we just really need to get on with this and put this thing into law as soon as I put my signature on it. And that's one of the criticisms of this governor at times. He doesn't have that finesse at times.
Do you think that any lessons were learned by Governor Snyder with that? I mean, it was a matter of two votes.
Well, you have to wonder.
Part of it is that he learned to never say the word vacation again in all of this. And I think he maybe might have learned that him pushing it might have done more harm than it did good. So, you know, if he would have picked up the phone and tried to make the case and they didn't go through, then it looks like, you know, then that whole line that the Democrats use that he can't, you know, push through members of his own party to do something once, then he fails. But, you know, so he was going to take hits from either side for doing it. But I think he's probably learned that what he does behind the scenes maybe is a little bit more effective than going out there in public and saying, you know, get back to work, guys, because that obviously did not work in this case.
Take a vote, not a vacation.
Yeah, and this is a guy who is a CEO by trade, and I think he might have learned that he's not their boss. They're equal branches of government, and they don't necessarily report to him like they would have if he was still at Gateway Computer, essentially.
What about the legislature in all of this? What do you think this whole Medicaid messiness, if you will, means for lawmakers, especially the ones running in 14?
Well, kind of going forward, this kind of takes a lot of the air out of the building for any other big issues, in particular road funding. There doesn't seem to be much appetite to raise taxes. There wasn't before, and there's even less now. That a lot of this political capital, not just from the governor, but from some of the Republican leadership who pushed this, they've essentially really kind of cashed out on Medicaid, and they're not necessarily going to. Senator Randy Richerville, the majority leader, he doesn't seem to be interested in going back and trying to rattle his caucus any further. And so you kind of wonder what if anything the legislature is going to kind of get done here going forward. One big issue that will probably be on their plate eventually is that Right to Life of Michigan is going to put a ballot initiative in their lap that would essentially try to ban basic insurance coverage from covering abortions. But that'll be a hot topic, but a lot of the stuff going forward is going to be kind of small.
Yeah, I would agree. I think, you know, Senator Richerville is a former championship baseball player, and he understands, you know, the game of small ball. There's not going to be any more home runs, I don't think, this fall. You know, they're going to be bunting and moving people around the bases slowly and methodically. So you're going to see a lot of district-specific bills. You know, that they've carried the water for the governor on a lot of big agenda items. They've done some leadership, you know, agenda items. And now they're going to be turning to their members and saying, okay, what's on your plate? And, you know, that's also code for helping their members get reelected to do something more specific for their district. So I think you're going to see a lot of small issues. But you're, like Jed said, you're not going to see any big overarching things, and that will come nowhere close to the heavy lift that Medicaid was.
Chris Gouts, who's Capital Correspondent for Crane's Detroit Business. And he's joined by Chad Livengood, who's the Lansing reporter for the Detroit News. As we look ahead, now that the Medicaid expansion has been passed in Michigan, looking ahead to the fall, and certainly roads has been on the agenda. The governor is wanting more than $1 billion more in money, but sorry, I have to say it. This issue seems to have run out of gas, hasn't it?
It does, or it has hit the proverbial wall, maybe the embankment of the highway, or it has a flat tire. You just insert your antidote here.
Yeah.
It's everywhere they try to. Every road here leads back to a tax increase, and they've tried looking at this subject every different direction, and really it's just a matter of, do you want to increase the gasoline tax, or do you want to ask the voters to increase the sales tax to pay for the subtraction of sales tax from gasoline when you increase the overall gas tax? It's not an easy just up or down vote. There's steps involved here, and steps plus the need to, you know, get 2/3 majority in both chambers to put something before voters just makes it a lot more complicated.
Yeah, I agree. You're not going to see the big deal. One thing I have been hearing people say is that you could at least try to, you know, you can nibble around the edges a little bit. You could change the tax at the wholesale level, which was part of the overall plan. Proponents of that idea say that while that wouldn't have any direct impact on the price of the pump currently, in the future it would solve some of the problem. So that could be something that they could say, you know, we did this piece of it. So you could come away with sort of a victory on roads, but that would be more of a long-term gain. It wouldn't really have any short-term implications.
Let me get your thoughts on some of the other issues that presumably, you know, is on the collective plate of the legislature. Let's start with Common Core. Who wants first?
Where do we want to start with Common Core? Yeah, essentially this is adopting nationally accepted standards for education in our schools. It's been an effort led by the Governors Association and the state school chiefs. It has run into a lot of opposition, particularly from conservative Republicans who believe this is a top-down effort to try to somehow dumb down education or make it sanitized and standardized. And it's really kind of set off a lot of very anti-government fervor in the legislature these days. They had some very lengthy hearings this summer that kind of turned into a bit of a sideshow at times.
Yeah, I think that's the case. And this is one that almost rises to the level of Medicaid expansion, because it's going to be so hard to cobble together Republican support for this in both chambers in order to get it approved. So this could fall victim to, you know, that whole idea of we're not going to make our members take any really tough votes, although there probably are quite a few Republicans that are chomping at the bit to vote against this. But in terms of getting it passed, if it doesn't happen, it's going to be because they just couldn't get enough Republicans who have their people in their district already howling at them over Medicaid expansion and some other things, that this might be one that falls apart.
And what does that say about just where the legislature is in being effective?
Well, it's just one of these issues where the climate is getting, like Chris said, just too toxic for them at home, that this might just be put off to the lame duck session of 2014, of December of 2014, as will maybe roads, for that matter, when people are termed out and don't have to run for re-election or just won their third term and they can take a vote without without feeling any major consequences from voters in the future. You're seeing this timidness, especially in the Senate Republicans. They didn't have to stand for re-election last fall, and so now they are starting to plot their course and finding that they need to take certain votes certain ways. And let's be clear, Common Core was adopted by the State Board of Education in the state. The governor backs it, but this is a legislative block of funding to implement it, essentially, trying to bar the Department of Education from spending one dime on it, similar to the way that the legislature barred the Department of Transportation from spending one dime on a new bridge to Canada.
And then the school district stuck in the middle because they've been trying to prepare for what they thought would be implementation of Common Core.
The school districts have spent a lot of money preparing for this, updating curriculum and whatnot. Curriculum directors, you know, salaries are very much tied to Common Core implementation. So they're definitely right in the middle of this and don't seem to have much voice with some members of the legislature these days.
Chris Gouts, what are your thoughts on the prospects for reforming Michigan's no-fault auto insurance?
I don't think the prospects are high in terms of the overall bill, but I've been told by folks in both chambers that is going to be up for discussion in both in the House and in the Senate. There is some appetite for doing something. I just watching all the hearings in the previous session and again this year, it doesn't seem like there's enough votes to do the wholesale change supporters of this want to see. But there are some fraud prevention pieces that have, you know, large bipartisan support. And even from those who are opposing, the groups that are opposing, you know, changing the no-fault policy, they support the fraud piece. So it'll really be up to leadership to decide whether or not they want it, if they want to splinter off the pieces that there is support for to do those and forgo the large bill, knowing that the only way you're probably ever going to get a large bill is if included in that are some of these things that people do support. So that's going to be a real big discussion piece, I think, into the fall.
The biggest component of no-fault auto insurance reform centers around getting rid of Michigan's unlimited medical benefits for being in an auto accident, the Catastrophic Claims Fund. One little test of this issue, which is a bill sponsored by Representative Jeff Farrington from Utica, that would essentially exempt senior citizens from the requirement that they buy this $185 a year coverage that gives them catastrophic claims coverage. And this will be kind of a test. If the legislature can't do something for seniors, it's hard to see how they're going to do this for the entire driving population.
And speaking of doing something for someone, for the brick and mortar stores through Michigan, for everyone that's had every one of those retailers that have had someone walk in, look at something, and go, "Okay, thanks, I'm going to go buy that online." What's the progress toward this Main Street fairness requiring the online sales tax?
It just passed out of committee, and I think all of those involved know that that's probably the last stop that it's going to make in this legislative session. Even the chair of the committee doesn't support it, but he knew that enough of his members were interested in voting for it that he didn't stand in the way. Again, Representative Farrington in this case, but he abstained from voting. And he and the governor and so many others believe that this is a federal issue and that Congress needs to deal with it, which they don't seem to be having any interest in doing, although there is some talk now of doing something, but I highly doubt that it really happening. But yeah, this is a federal issue, and I think everyone knows that it's probably not going to go any farther at the state level.
So don't hold your breath if you're a retailer, and don't worry about it if you're an online shopper.
I wouldn't. Local retailers can continue to be a proving ground for products, and then people will scan the item on their iPhones and then go home and buy it after they've tested it at the local shop and go buy it online.
Mm-mm-mm. Great discussion as always. Chris Gouts, Capital Correspondent for Crane's Detroit Business, and Chad Livengood, Lansing Reporter for the Detroit News. Look forward to checking in with you both again very, very soon.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Peg Watson. Contributors are Allie Billings, Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Mercedes Mejia, and Katie Suha. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening, and let's talk tomorrow afternoon at 3:00.